Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
We recently moved out to North Carolina, where we now live on a homestead of 9 acres, just in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. So it's a really wonderful to be with you all. Even though it's via Zoom, I'm sorry that I was not able to make it in person. And of course, we're here talking about what do I do with my free time? And I'm just going to answer that question immediately, you know, with the original title that I was given, and I'm just going to kind of stick with it, which is leisure and contemplation. So, you know, when you think about what do I do with my free time, you know, I'm married with 6 kids and multiple jobs. And like I said, trying to get a homestead set up. So I'm like, free time. Yeah. What is free time? I don't know. You know, but leisure is not free time, right? We're going to unpack what it does really mean, though. What is leisure? One time I was actually writing a piece about leisure for, you know, a blog called Those Catholic Men. This was, I don't know, like 6 years ago or something. And so I wrote something like, what's the purpose of leisure? And the guy who was setting up the blog post chose these people like playing Frisbee, you know, as the image for leisure. And I was like, that's not really what I'm saying in the piece that I wrote. So we're going to unpack what does that word really mean? And we're going to look at one particular aspect of what we can and should be doing in the midst of genuine leisure, and that is the contemplation of reality. You know, just a light, you know, topic here. So I look forward to diving into this with you. It's really great as well, just on another kind of personal note before kind of getting into the talk more deeply here. To speak for the Thomistic Institute, my alma mater is the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, not the one down in Houston. There's another one down there, but the one in Minnesota. And I did my dissertation on St. Thomas Aquinas at Ave Maria University. And my topic was on the virtue of religion, which is related to this topic, because the virtue of religion seeks to order everything to God's glory, every single one of our actions, right? So I think as we advance, we'll kind of see how that fits in with our topic here tonight. I want to start, though, with a question. If somebody asked you this, what is the problem of our time? How would you respond? I mean, there's so many possibilities, right? You might think of this particular political problem or that one. You might, you know, think, you know, education is going down the tube, family. But if we were to really get behind all of those things, we might say that even though we have the most technologically advanced civilization in history, we have the most powerful civilization in terms of wealth, military capabilities. We would also have the most educated, you know, population even throughout the entire world and on all of human history. So on the surface, everything seems to be going very well, right? And so we might think, okay, well, in the midst of that, we have these little particular problems cropping up in our country. There's a fentanyl crisis, drug abuse crisis. There's a rising problem of homelessness. There is a birth crisis. You know, we have dropped below kind of replacement rate in our own country, and we're going to have a demographic crisis, not the one that everyone said for decades, this problem of overpopulation. We're going to have a problem of underpopulation. And of all people, it's Elon Musk who's pointing that out to the world right now. Hey, we're not going to have enough people to sustain our society moving forward. There's a lot of different things we could point to. But I actually want to answer the question in a way that might be surprising. Have you ever heard of that word before? Do you know how to pronounce it? What is that word? Achadia. It's coming from the Greek Acadia, but and you know, easily pronounce it in the Latin version, Acadia. What in the world is that? And it is a kind of sloth. What is sloth? Let me say, well, do we know what that word is either? Sloth, of course, is not taking up our duties, not kind of entering into the work that needs to be done, the responsibilities that need to be done. But Acadia has also been recognized as one of the deadly sins. You know, the deadly sins are not simply, we also call them the capital sins, right? They're deadly not just because they're so bad. They're deadly because they lead to other sins, right? And they tend to proliferate in that sense, you know, and take us down as a whole. How could this possibly be the problem of our time? Because in a spiritual sense, St. Thomas Aquinas defined Acadia as flight from God as friend. Flight from God. And we can think of that from a broader perspective. We might say, okay, well, I don't want to take St. Thomas Aquinas' definition. Okay, yeah, well, we can look at it even from the viewpoint more broadly of leisure. The unwillingness to ascend to the heights, right? This holding back in what is most immediate. And it's very interesting that this problem of sloth is manifested in our society not by inactivity, but by overactivity, by distraction, frenetic activity, we might even say, jumping from one thing to another, to another, to another, to another, and not looking at what matters most. We don't ask, what is everything for? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What is the purpose of my life? What should I do with my time? Right? And to bring it back to our topic here, we don't ask those questions because we are not even able to engage in that kind of thinking because of the frenetic distraction. One thing to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. No silence, no peace, and no real depth. That's why it's the problem of our time. You go back to all these other problems, right? But we could say that everything else is a manifestation of a problem that starts right here, right behind this microphone. No, deeper down inside, right? You know, this is where all of the problems of the world come from. Not from this economic policy, not from that one political party. Oh, if we just change political parties, that would solve everything. We want to say, no, there's a deeper problem, and it's here within us, that our society prioritizes what's on the surface and not what matters most. So, in response to that, we want to look at leisure as an answer to Acadia. Because leisure is, once again, it's not simply recreation, you know, enjoyment, fun, free time. It's not any of these things, right? I mean, it might have some relation to them, but that's not what leisure is in its essence. Right. Leisure is the freedom and ability to enter into our highest actions as human beings. And that does require time. That's why we speak of leisure time. Right. We need the time to be able to do these things because what's going to happen, right? We get sucked into our busyness. And so leisure is saying, everything else must stop. All of this frenetic activity must at least pause. And I have to have the ability to do what matters most. And I really love this litmus test for leisure. Is this action intrinsically worthwhile? That is, do I do it for its own sake, not for the sake of something else? And I'm going to give some examples, right? not to trash activities, but to judge them from the viewpoint of leisure, right? And I think this is hard for us as Americans because we are utilitarian. And we want to see everything in terms of its value, its practical value in particular, its monetary value. Time is money, right? You know, I could be using this time to make a profit. I could be using this time, maybe a recreation, so that I can enter more deeply into work. But the greatest work on leisure was written by a German philosopher, Joseph Pieper. It was written after the Second World War, when he said, in response to this kind of national crisis we're going through after the Second World War, we need to think about what matters most. And of course, there was a lot of rebuilding that had to be done. And he said that we do not enter into leisure in order to work, as if it were a way of just getting some needed rest so that we can enter back into the work week after the weekend, able to just pull an even better shift. He said, no, we work for the sake of leisure. And that's actually a quote from Aristotle, right, that he pulled out. We work for the sake of leisure. That is, we attend to the sort of the ordinary and the mundane needs of our lives. Supporting myself, supporting my family, doing the things that need to be done for the common good of society. But all of those things are done ultimately so that I can do the things that matter most. Of course, that leads to the question, well, what matters most, you know? But you really have a gift, right? Even by being in college right now, you have a gift of leisure. The Greek word for leisure is skole, and that is where we get the word school. And, you know, if you want to think throughout all of human history, most children did not go to school. Most young adults did not go to university. Didn't even exist, you know, for large stretches of history. It's a gift to have leisure to pursue the formation of your mind, of your soul. But do we use this time for that, right? We have to say, okay, I have this time in which I do not have to work full time, at least. I know you may have part time jobs, but I have this time. Do I use it to really not just be prepared to do something, but to be someone, to be the person that I can become if I give my all, if I develop myself at the deepest level, not just utilitarian abilities? One of the best examples that I like of leisure was actually given by another German, not a philosopher, but a theologian, Romano Guardini. He said, what about play? And when you think about it, just sitting down and playing dolls or playing blocks or a board game with children, we do it just for its own sake. It's not to be refreshed. It's not for making money, obviously. It doesn't have a utilitarian purpose. It's just something in which we delight. And so Guardini said, maybe play teaches us something about life. We like to be so serious, but maybe we actually need to be a little lighter to reach the things that matter most. So just kind of keep that in mind. I wanted to give some contrasts here in thinking about the nature of leisure. My son, Daniel, who's 15, is a big Dune fan, so he can't wait to go to the theaters this weekend to see Dune 1.2 or whatever, the second part of the first part of Dune. But I think it's very important when we're thinking about leisure not to view it as entertainment. And that is not a knock on entertainment. There's actually nothing wrong with entertainment. I mean, entertainment can be bad, right? So, I mean, it could be bad entertainment. And it's also bad if it dominates our life, right? If we live for entertainment, then that's a disorder. But entertainment has its place. But let's look at the example of film. The Dark Knight, right? I'm going to say that that's entertainment, right? But we can compare it to what I view to be a work of leisure. And as we unpack leisure, maybe you'll understand this more even as I go along a little bit farther. If you haven't seen this film, I can't recommend it highly enough. By the American filmmaker Terrence Malick, but it is about an Austrian farmer and how he is conscripted into the Nazi army. He's not a pacifist. He was actually part of the Austrian army previously, but he refuses to take an oath of allegiance to Hitler. And I think, unlike other movies, other films, it's not even simply just trying to tell his story. Right, because even there we might say, okay, like a film made about a saint, is it a work of leisure? Sometimes it's not, right? It's just trying to tell you a story about a saint. But I view this film as a work of leisure because it's very contemplative. It's slow moving. It's artistic. You really enter into the Austrian countryside. You enter into the joys and difficulties of family life. And it really asks the question, what are the things that matter most? Which is what leisure is about. How about two different concerts? One is a sensation that's sweeping the nation. No, the universe. Taylor Swift concert. Everybody wants to go see Taylor Swift. And I would say the same thing, right? That this is maybe entertainment. I don't know. Would I even say that now? Yeah. But it's something that is really engaging on an emotional level, if that's your thing, right? If you're a Swiftie, right? No, I mean, I would say it's something that I don't want to dismiss, its importance and popularity in people's lives, but it's, let's just be honest, right? I mean, does it touch us in the very deepest level? Now, maybe somebody's willing to go to bat for Taylor Swift and say, no, her music does. But I'm going to say that it's probably not the most profound. I know I'm really, that's going out on a limb, but I'm going to say it's probably not the most profound. Now, I'd like to think back in contrast to that to my first orchestral concert. I was an exchange student to Poland when I was 16 years old. I turned 16. Said goodbye to my family, got on a plane, and went to newly liberated Poland in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was invited to travel down to Wrocław, where another American was living, and we went to a Beethoven concert. And I have to say that at that moment, time simply stopped. And I was pulled out of myself, not on an emotional level. It wasn't just that the music was pleasing, but it really drew me somewhere. And I would say somewhere profound. Was it a religious experience? I don't know if I would go that far, but I would say it was a true experience of leisure for me. One that has shaped my life in the sense that it drew me into sort of an engaged encounter with classical music, and I think in leisure. What about the gym, right? And I'm not knocking the gym. I mean, and it can be probably unhealthy if it becomes an obsession once again, right? Almost anything is when it becomes an obsession. But is it for its own sake? We might say, no, it's for my health, or I want to be strong, I want to be fit, or I want to show off my abs, or I don't know, whatever it is, right? It's for another purpose, right? What we say, is it intrinsically worthwhile? Does it pull me into the deepest elements of reality? But I would simply say, just taking a little walk with my kids, especially when they're young, right? The younger, the better, I almost say, is a contemplative experience. Daddy, look at that. And then you just stop. What kind of bird is that? Look at that flower. And it's intrinsically worthwhile, right? It is for its own sake to say, this was something deeply meaningful, and I felt like it drew me out of myself. It made me, in a way, maybe in an intuitive way, to think about reality, to engage with reality. Now, how do we connect with other people, right? And everybody says, we're more connected than ever, but less connected than ever at the same time, right? And there's this difficult interplay. But I think even the reading that we do on a screen is jumbled. Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brain, I think says it best. He says, we hunt and peck for information. And he says that literally rewires our brain. Now, thankfully, our brains are very plastic and they can be wired different directions and it's not permanent. But he says it makes it so that it's difficult for us to sustain deep reading and deep thinking because we jump from one thing to the next. What about a deeper connection that we have with people through prayer? Right? And it's something you can't put your finger on, but we're all there facing the same direction, especially in this picture, right? We're here for something beyond ourselves. Right? It's not just distracting myself. You don't go to mass for yourself. And this kind of goes back to my dissertation on the virtue of religion in St. Thomas Aquinas. The virtue of religion gives God what is owed to him. And we don't think about owing anything to God, but we do, right? I mean, where did our life come from? Where are we going? And ultimately, but philosophy can address those questions. Plato and Aristotle thought about those questions and had pretty good answers, actually. But ultimately, these are questions that take us beyond our ordinary experience. And in this transcendent contemplation, we become more united than in any other activity. And so Pieper says that worship is the highest expression of leisure. But it's hard to judge things unless we have a standard, right? How could we say that a Beethoven concert is deeper than a Taylor Swift concert? Well, I think we can do that, but we should say first, we should ask the question, who are we? And Socrates, in his apology, and if you haven't read Plato's apology, right? So this is Socrates' defense, not like I'm sorry for my life. No, the apologia means his defense. When Socrates gives the defense of his life, he says, the unexamined life is not worth living. The Athenians put him to death. Why? Because he says he went around like a horsefly and got them to think about their lives. He wanted them to examine their lives, but there was a problem. They didn't want to. They didn't want to think deeply about their lives. I was actually reading the apology with a group of high schoolers recently. I said, the Athenians are like us, aren't they? Athens was a wealthy city, and they didn't want to be bothered. The unexamined life is not worth living. Who are we? What are we? That's a pretty big question right now. And it takes leisure to be able to really contemplate that question. What is my nature? The word nature actually comes from birth in Latin. You're born with a given nature, right? You're not born as a flower. You're not born as a dog. You're born as somebody that can listen to this boring lecture and hopefully understand some things that I'm saying, right? A dog can't do that. A flower certainly cannot do that unless it's hiding something from us. And so we have a certain nature. We have a certain capacity to do things that we can do and other beings can't do. And when you think about our nature, that you can then say, well, what is the order of our nature? And the word order in Greek could be rendered as telos. A lot of times it's the goal or the end. But I like to think of that as the order, right? That there's a direction to our lives. And we say, well, how can we say that, right? Because a lot of people would call that into question. And for the Greek philosophers, it was simply thinking about the acts that make us human. Like, what can we do that animals cannot do? Is it feelings? Well, actually, animals have feeling. Is it just perception? Well, animals have perception too. So the Greeks identified two acts, which we could even say are constitutive. They make up, they comprise our nature, right? Because we are animals, but we're rational animals, according to Boethius's definition, right? We're rational animals. That is that, so we share with animals our certain kind of bodies that have perception and feeling. But in addition, we have what we call intellectus, our ability to understand. A dog cannot know what it means to be a dog. Can't even ask that question. But a human being can do what we're doing right now and say, do I have a nature? What is my nature? What's the goal of my nature? That's something that pertains to our intellect. And then free will. Now, animals make choices, right? If I put a bowl of lettuce and a bowl of, you know, chopped steak in front of a dog, I wonder what it will choose, you know? And according to its instinct, right, it will choose the meat. That's what dogs do. But if you do the same thing to a human being might say, oh, that steak smells so good, but I'll take the bowl of salad. Why? Well, because it's healthier for me. Or maybe it's because it's a Friday in Lent, and so I'm going to make a sacrifice. So what does that mean? We do not simply act upon instinct. We can think about things, and we can make a choice based on our intellect. And that's free will. And animals do not have that. All right, so to know and to love, that's the perfection of intellect and will, to know and to love. And we should evaluate how we use our free time, you know, how we make use of the time that we are given in our lives by our highest actions, knowing the truth and loving what is good. And to know what is good, we have to think about it. How do we often use our intelligence, power, utility, and pleasure, right? We use our intelligence to farther those aims. So we don't go for what's highest. But then we might say, well, let's ask another question. What is highest? And according to Plato and Aristotle and also St. Thomas Aquinas, our highest action is contemplation. And contemplation is a way of knowing that actually involves free will. It actually involves love. Because according to Pieper, as he's unpacking this, right, he says that contemplation comes from affirmation. And you think of that example of taking a walk with children. When they look at that flower, they appreciate it. They want to look. They open their eyes. They want to see it. And they love it. Might pluck it, but that's because they love it so much they want to take it home to mom, you know? But that's the kind of receptivity that is needed for our highest action. To look at reality, to grasp it, even in a way that exceeds our ability to grasp. That is, it's not even just our reasoning capability, like to put something under a microscope and to say, I understand it. No. It's to look at the whole, to be drawn out of myself and into the fullness of life and to say, yes, I want that. I am a part of that. And I affirm that. It's something that has to come out of a silent receptivity, which is why the scrolling undermines leisure so much. And according to St. Thomas Aquinas, contemplation, whether it's the contemplation of the poetic or it's the contemplation of the philosopher, it begins in wonder. And another name for wonder could be awe. We just kind of take a step back and we're even overwhelmed, but in a good way, by the fullness of things. And it leads us to joy. That's our highest action. And it's so important that it's built into the very fabric of our creation. We think of the 7 days. This image is from the St. John's Bible, this new illumination of the whole Bible written out by hand on parchment. On the sixth day of creation, God made us in his image and likeness. That is, we are beings who can know, who can love, who can be in communion with others. He made us to be like himself. And then he stopped, right? The work of creation was not done on the sixth day. The work of creation found its completion on the seventh day in rest. Something beyond our busyness. Something beyond all of the things that capture our attention, the useful things, the pleasurable things. And it's a mistake to understand rest as inactivity. Because what is the kind of rest that the seventh day points us to? It's this kind of rest. It's a contemplative rest. And so the seventh day shows us that simply being is more important than doing. And God himself told us this at the burning bush. Who are you, Lord? Who should I tell the people enslaved in Egypt who you are? And he says, I am who am. I simply am. I am the one who is the fullness of life and of being. And to show you that I am not defined by my work, I will lead you to my rest. Because my rest is the fullness of life. And that's our goal. Our goal is not to create this perfect place for ourselves here and now, because we can't. That's the task of utopia, which means no place, because it can't happen. We're made for something more. And leisure reminds us of that. Everything else has to stop. And when you really experience leisure, it's like that experience that I had at the Beethoven concert or the experience of a little kid taking a walk. Everything else just goes away. And you're drawn into that moment. That's all that there is. I am who am. Don't worry about anything else. This is it. This is the fullness. But another way of saying that Echadia is our problem is saying that we're enslaved to the busyness of life. And like the Israelites who had to come to know God as I am, we must do the same. How important is the Sabbath? Well, you may know that God sent the Israelites into exile in Babylon. And he told the prophet Jeremiah, The reason he was sending them into exile is that they had not kept the Sabbath. And so that he was going to give them 70 years of exile to make up for all of the missed Sabbaths. That the people would have their rest. They had to have their rest because they couldn't be God's people without it. And the goal of our lives is eternal rest, not as an activity. How horrible would that be? Oh, I'm going to enjoy life now because in eternity, I'm just going to be resting. So just give me that, you know, cloudy pillow. I'll just be taking a nap for eternity. No. Eternal rest is the fullness of life. Truly entering into life itself. And the glimpse of that that we have is the weekly festivity. Joseph Pieper may have said that worship was the highest expression of leisure. But the way that we see that is in the festival. He said, because that is how we affirm the goodness of life. In our secular age, we think about worship as going to church. But in the Middle Ages, worship extended into culture. And festivity was praising God through singing, through dancing, through eating, through drinking. And that's why I wrote the book, The Beer Option, that's behind me here on the shelf. Brewing a Catholic Culture yesterday and today. And I get into a festivity a lot in that book. Is that it makes our life on earth something that is deeply kind of redeemed. That we don't simply in our leisure just kind of leave our life behind. You know, so it's not like worship is here and music and merriment and we could say entertainment, that's what we say today, is kind of left behind and out in the dark. That can be drawn into the highest in festivity. Is the way that we see that. Because for Pieper, it's the ultimate expression of joy. That I affirm the goodness of life by celebrating. And it's not just getting wasted. I mean, that's not an expression of joy, right? I mean, if you drink too much, if you eat too much, you're throwing up. That's not a yes, that's a no, that's an escape. Right? And so good singing, good dancing, good eating, good drinking draws us together and lifts us to something bigger than ourselves. What's one way that we see this in our culture? It's the wedding feast. It's an affirmation of the goodness and joy of life and of love. Although that can go south as well, but hopefully it doesn't, right? But that's one way in which we see festivities staying in our culture. But every Sunday is meant to be a festive day. So now I think we're ready to answer this question a little bit more directly. What do we do with our free time? Well, for one, we should never be bored, right? Boredom is a modern problem, right? You know, I think people who think that they always need to be busy get bored. But if we understand leisure properly, we shouldn't be bored. Neil Postman wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And I think you can only handle so much entertainment before you lose your mind and you lose the joy of life. And so what do we do with our time? Like, we can't be bored. We can't give in to the tyranny of amusements. We need to pull out of our distractions. We need to be present to others. Like taking that walk. Take a walk with other people. That's what my wife and I did. We at St. Thomas, our campus was right along the Mississippi River, and we used to walk along the river and talk. It was beautiful. We used to spend time in the chapel, right? In silence, right? And I would say we felt the closest when we were silent with one another and lived for the highest. And once again, that asks the question, what's the highest? And I want to actually walk through a series of steps. Throughout all of history, great philosophers and theologians kind of talked about the ascent to God. St. Bonaventure called it the journey of the mind to God. And we begin with the contemplation of nature, right? This contemplation, our highest act. And when you're contemplating nature, you're not saying, oh, look at those beautiful trees. What species are they? What kind of needles do they have? I mean, that's fine. But the contemplation, when you're just drawn out of yourself, and I'm sure you've probably had this experience, especially if you've gone anywhere as beautiful as this, you just stop and you just go, ah, right? It's a moment. It's an experience of something bigger than myself and of beauty, right? Beauty is this kind of spark that leads me into truth and to goodness, right? That beauty is the spark that makes you fall in love. And the beauty of nature can lead you beyond itself, right? Beauty is an invitation to something. And we don't worship nature, right? Nature points us, it should be, you know, to the next step, right? This beauty is an expression of something. What is behind it? What's the meaning of this? And that leads us to the next level of contemplation, the contemplation of art. And this is Van Gogh's contemplation of a mountain ravine. And art is an interpretation of nature and life. It's not simply a reproduction, right? And when I look at this, I do feel an emotional tension, right? We are emotional beings. It's not that we can't engage our emotions. We should, but they just need to be drawn up above themselves, right? Because emotions are animalistic and we're called to something higher than that. But I have an emotional response to this painting. There's tension. I kind of feel like maybe this stream is going to pull me into a dark place. But on the other end of this ravine, there's something that lifts me upwards, right? And the artist becomes a great interpreter of reality. I mean, this is just a photograph. Now, I mean, you need to really be there to have the contemplative experience, but nonetheless, I mean, I'm just looking at nature, but here I'm looking at the artist's interpretation of nature. And it helps me to think and to contemplate perhaps even more deeply than simply just looking at the nature itself. I can get deeper into the artist's vision, and the vision might be good or it might be bad. I mean, there is bad art that's not really worth contemplating, and it won't help you to do so. But you can see, I think, with Van Gogh's, you know, his energetic brushworks that he's famous for here. I mean, he puts a lot of energy in it, and it makes me think that, well, maybe there is something deeper. Like I feel like maybe something is communicating with me from nature here. Now, what's interesting is that the next step goes far beyond that. And this is an excerpt from Plato's dialogue, the Theaetetus, where Socrates is speaking to this teenage boy, Theaetetus, and he's saying that at a certain point, the philosopher is no longer even concerned with considering particulars, not particular trees and lakes and nature, and not even the symbols that are employed by artists, but thinking about the nature of reality itself. It's the next step that goes into the essence of things. And so Socrates says, I will illustrate my meeting, Theodorus, who's Theaetus's dad, by the jest with the clever, witty Thracian handmaid, is said to have made about Thales when he fell into a well as he was looking up at the stars. She said that he was so eager to know what was going on in heaven that he could not see what was before his feet. This is a jest which is equally applicable to all philosophers. For the philosopher is wholly unacquainted with his next door neighbor. And I don't recommend that, by the way, but he is ignorant not only of what he is doing, but he hardly knows whether he is a man or an animal in the concrete, right? Because he is searching for into the essence of man. He's not concerned about whether he's a man or not. He's concerned about what does it mean to be a man? And busy in inquiring what belongs to such a nature to do or suffer different from any other. And thus, my friend, on every occasion, private as well as public, as I said at first, when he appears in a law court or in any place in which he has to speak of things which are at his feet and before his eyes, he is the jest, right? The butt of jokes, not only of Thracian handmaids, but of the general herd, tumbling into wells and every other sort of disaster through his inexperience. His awkwardness is fearful and gives the impression of imbecility. When he is reviled, he has nothing personal to say in answer to the civilities of his adversaries, for he knows no scandals of anyone. He's not concerned with the tabloids, right? And they do not interest him, and therefore he is laughed at for his sheepishness. And when others are being praised and glorified in the simplicity of his heart, he cannot help going into fits of laughter, so that he seems to be a downright idiot, right? In his innocence and joy, just contemplating the nature of things. And I want to go deeper into this. I have another slide, but we don't have enough time. So I'm just going to move into the next level. So if we think that contemplation begins just in the experience of things, and then it ascends into the kind of the symbol of art, whether it's poetry or great literature or painting. But then we go farther, that what is even the purpose of great literature? To get you to contemplate the nature of reality itself. And that's what the philosopher does. And, you know, Socrates is making a joke here, right? Plato is trying to be witty in this whole story by pointing to the foolishness of the philosopher, that he's more concerned with the heavens than what's underneath him. But to some degree, he's saying that is laudable. Right, that he should be concerned with the highest. That Socrates himself, in his defense, said, "I was willing to be poor to pursue the highest goods." But where does contemplation end? Ultimately, it is getting drawn up above ourselves. That the contemplation of God is something that goes beyond our own ability to contemplate and to grasp. And that when we come before God, we can most fully view all of reality through him and affirm its goodness through him. And we see this coming out in the Psalms, Psalm 24. Who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord? Hill or mountain, but it's Mount Zion, right? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift his soul to what is false, who does not swear deceitfully. He will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob, who want to gaze on him face to face in contemplation. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. And that's the highest element of contemplation. Not just an engagement with created reality, but allowing the King of glory to come in and to give us a glimpse into truth itself. And so to end, we must become free to see, right? Not to be enslaved by distraction. So we have to fight for this gift of leisure, to embrace a deeper peace of mind, and to stop ourselves in silence and to look and to listen and to receive. Have meaningful conversations about things that really matter. Immerse yourselves in beauty, whether that's, you know, beautiful paintings, music, literature. Challenge your mind. You know, reading things that are difficult, not just escape literature or television, because, you know, television and movies makes us passive in a bad way, not in a contemplative way. I mean, unless it's the right movie, as I mentioned, right? But when you read literature, your mind has to engage much more deeply with it, and we become active, and then that might lead us to mind with what is worthy of thought and worthy of love. Be lifted out of yourself and ascend to the heights. That is how we should use our time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.